Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on the future of the Corporate Transparency Act. Our speaker today is Professor Thomas Lee. Professor Lee is the Leitner Family Professor of International Law at Fordham Law School. He's also the co-director of the Center on Asian Americans in the Law, special counsel at Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed, and a member of the American Law Institute. He was special counsel to the general counsel of the U.S. Department of Defense, a member of the ICSID panel of conciliators, and a visiting professor at Columbia, Harvard, and the University of Virginia Law Schools. If you'd like to learn more about today's speaker, his full bio can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our speaker gives his presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Lee, thank you for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much, Caroline, for that introduction. And I'd like to begin with my own prefaces, which is I'm representing neither my law firm, Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed, the Department of Defense, the U.S. government, or Fordham Law School, and I'm speaking strictly in my personal capacity about the Corporate Transparency Act. I'm going to begin with a little bit of background about the statute and the lawsuits that we had brought on behalf of the National Small Business Association and some of our and one of our members, Isaac Winkles, in the Northern District of Alabama in 2022. And then hopefully fast forward to the most recent decisions and where the litigation is presently. So by way of background, the statute, the Corporate Transparency Act, was part of the National Defense Authorization Act, passed over presidential veto in January of 2021. It was scheduled to come into full effect January of this year. And what it is, for those of you, I was told that some of you are very familiar with the statute, some of you are not familiar at all, but what the statute was intended to do was to require everyone who had set up an LLC or an S corporation or any kind of entity by filing a certificate of incorporation with the state secretary of state to report certain information about beneficial owners and applicants to the Department of Treasury's Financial Intelligence Unit, the FinCEN, Financial Criminal Enforcement Network. And so the information that entities that were set up under state law were required to report would be the name, birth date, address, and active identification number of beneficial owners and certain applicants for a database that FinCEN would manage and allow access to federal agencies, state agencies, foreign agencies that make asks through proper channels with respect to the ownership of entities that are set up under any state or tribal laws, unless they are explicitly exempted by FinCEN under the statute. So a couple of things. So when we brought the lawsuit, there were three buckets of challenges in our initial complaint. The first were the idea that Congress lacked constitutional power to enact this statute because entity formation was historically something that was regulated by the states since the founding of the Republic and even before that. And the way the statute works, it doesn't actually mention any requirement that the entity have engaged in interstate or foreign commerce. The trigger is the grant of the certificate by the state secretary of state. And if you're not exempted, you have to give this information regardless of whether you connect any commercial activity. So our first basket of arguments was that whether under the Commerce Clause, the taxing power, or foreign relations powers, Congress did not have the constitutional authority under Article 1 or any other constitutional power to enact this statute based on the mere existence of this entity rather than whether it engaged in interstate or foreign commerce. So that's the argument that prevailed in the district court in the Northern District of Alabama. We were granted summary judgment on that argument in March of 2024, last year. And once that summary judgment was granted, it applied only to the parties, that is NSBA and Mr. Winkles. And so right after the summary judgment is granted, the government appealed to the 11th Circuit, and we agreed on an expedited briefing schedule, and it was argued on September 27th before the 11th Circuit panel. I argued the case in September 27th of 2024. After that win in the district court, there were a number of suits brought in other jurisdictions, including one in Texas, and those were brought in a preliminary injunction posture. We had filed our suit early enough and we'd asked for a permanent injunctive relief, but it was limited to the parties to the litigation. There was a chance, we thought, that FinCEN would unilaterally stall or delay enforcement of the statute while the litigation challenges were being heard by the courts. FinCEN chose not to do that. One of the other suits brought in Texas by Texas Top Cop Shop and NFIB ultimately prevailed in December in the grant of a preliminary injunction in the district court in Texas. So once the preliminary injunction was granted, it went to a motions panel. The government appealed the grant of the preliminary injunction. One interesting aspect, although the parties had not requested preliminary injunction to be applied nationwide, they just requested on behalf of their parties, the district judge decided to apply a nationwide injunction to everyone who would be subject to the reporting requirements under the CTA. The motions panel of the Fifth Circuit initially granted the government's motion to stay that preliminary injunction. Subsequently, this all happened actually over the end of December. The motions panel, the merits panel overruled the motions panel and reinstated the preliminary injunction. At that point, the government filed for a stay application at the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court, the government, it's fairly brief now. And so right now we're waiting on a decision on the stay application at the Supreme Court. Now, going back to our litigation, I told you that we were not in a preliminary injunction posture. The 11th Circuit heard arguments. The decision from the 11th Circuit panel is pending. We anticipate that the government will not pursue any further action or strike that. The 11th Circuit will probably wait to see how the Supreme Court disposes of the application for a stay by the Solicitor General. Now, in the Texas action, it's likely that the Supreme Court will have a decision very soon regarding the nationwide injunction, which the parties had not asked for. And we anticipate that ruling anytime. The 11th Circuit is likely waiting on our case to see what happens at the Supreme Court on the preliminary injunction. Going back, I said that we had had three buckets of arguments against the CTA and both courts to have ruled in our favor. I should also mention that there have been similar requests for PIs in other circuits, the 4th, the 9th, the 1st, the 6th. And so far, none of the other requests have been granted. They're at various stages in those other actions. But to go back to the arguments that we'd raised, the district courts that ruled in our favor ruled on the constitutional power arguments. But we'd also raised a second set of individual rights arguments based on the fact that this type of disclosure of information regarding beneficial owners constitutes an unreasonable search and seizure. If you'll recall, the idea behind the whole statute was to help law enforcement fight money laundering and illicit transfers of funds to support anti-terrorism efforts and money laundering initiatives. And our argument had been, well, if somebody sets up a corporation It's a fundamentally innocent activity. There's no suspicion. There's no reasonable suspicion. There's definitely not a warrant. And so to put that information into a criminal law enforcement database subject to penalties for failure to comply also constitutes an unreasonable search and seizure. We'd also raised First Amendment compelled speech, Fifth Amendment self-incrimination arguments. Neither the district courts decided the individual rights arguments. On our appeal to the 11th Circuit, we had raised the Fourth Amendment argument as an alternative basis for affirming our summary judgment. Right now, those arguments are pending. The third set of arguments, if you go back to the way the statute's designed, it defines a set of beneficial owners whose information, whose personal information must be reported to FinCEN. And the definition of beneficial owner turns on who has substantial control over that entity. And in the regulations enforcing that particular term, substantial control, the government sort of says, well, it's anyone who has substantial influence over significant decisions by the entity. And so we felt that that standard is particularly vague. It doesn't really, I mean, anyone, if you think about of a mom and pop business, there are many individuals who, family members who might have some say about important decisions that the entity undertakes. And so there's another set of arguments under Fifth Amendment due process vagueness jurisprudence. And again, lower courts did not decide on that. So those are the three types of arguments that we made: constitutional power, individual rights, vagueness. The lower courts decided on the constitutional power arguments. There's the Fifth Circuit preliminary injunction nationwide. And then in our case, there was a permanent injunction. I think that's pretty much a quick summary. And my intent, and I told Caroline this, was to sort of answer questions from all of you, because this is really a chance for you to ask questions about the litigation and what we might expect. One thing I'll say is, in light of the fact that President Trump had initially had his misgivings about the statute, it would not be surprising to me if the Department of Justice, since in the new administration, may effectively take a knee on this one. That's something interesting to observe, how the Department of Justice's litigation policy would change with the new administration.
Great, Professor. As the professor mentioned, this is a great opportunity to submit questions in the chat box, but I think someone has a question on if you could explain a little bit more about the Fifth Amendment claims in all of this.
Yeah, so good question. And this one's actually kind of, as a constitutional law professor, this was an argument that personally interested me. And so I'm speaking in my personal capacity. There's a case called Boyd. It's an older case. And generally, in Fifth Amendment, you sort of have to, the idea is you can't incriminate yourself. And so the government argument, when we briefed that, was to say, well, there's no real criminal prosecution here. And so how is it possible that the self-incrimination privilege kicks in? Our argument was, well, you're using the request for information and you're putting it into a database, and you're affording the government the opportunity to potentially use it in a criminal context. So it's almost sort of like a Fourth and a Half Amendment type argument that basically you're being asked to supply information that could potentially be used against you in a criminal proceeding. So the Boyd case involved requirements for information with respect to imported goods, right? And so we felt like this idea of, if there's a foul to try to make somebody incriminate themselves with the prosecution or a trial in progress, the foul would seem greater when you don't even have that in progress, right? So you're asking for the individuals to turn over information that may potentially be used against them without even the prospect of a criminal investigation so that the government has an easier job of being able to track what they see as money laundering. So that was the nature of the Fifth Amendment claim. When we filed our arguments at the 11th Circuit, brief space is limited. We didn't really push the Fifth Amendment argument, but that's the nature of the particular argument that we were made.
Great. And then you touched on this a little bit, but I think someone's curious about, they say in the Western District of Michigan, pending case, the judge appears focused on the Fourth Amendment. Do you think the Fourth Amendment issues have legs?
We do. And Judge Jonker, who had denied the preliminary injunction, I don't remember exactly when, it was over the summer, he was very interested in the Fourth Amendment argument, and we do think it has legs. I mean, the idea there really is setting up an entity is a fundamentally innocent activity. And the way the statute operates, it seems unreasonable to pretty much presume that fundamentally innocent act is one that you would not have a reasonable expectation of privacy kick in for. People set up entities for all kinds of reasons. And it'd be one thing if the state required that information as a condition of setting up the entity, but for the federal government to ask for it to put into a database where it might be used against you, I mean, that doesn't seem like something that a reasonable person would have anticipated in setting up the entity, right? And so I, you know, again, speaking personally, in the record, we had sort of argued that ground to the 11th Circuit. You could look at the oral argument transcript. The panel didn't spend too much time on that. The judge in Michigan did think that, and the judge in Michigan actually brought up a great hypothetical, which is, look, what if they're not just asking for information? And I should add, the statute doesn't require a digital image of your active identification, but the regulations do. So you don't just have to turn over your information, your address, and your birthday. You actually have to upload a digital image of that identification. And so the hypothetical that the judge in Michigan asked was, well, what if they'd ask for a DNA swab, right? Like a cheek swab, would that be a violation of the Fourth Amendment? And so that's an excellent hypothetical, because really if there's not even a search at that point for Fourth Amendment purposes, I don't see why the government couldn't do that. And so our argument is essentially that it is an unreasonable search to require that.
Great, very helpful. Someone said, your thoughts on the nationwide injunction and whether SCOTUS might grant cert on that issue, or whether SCOTUS might limit the injunction. They claim that, you know, numerous justices frown on nationwide injunctions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so in the SG's briefing, they really focused on that aspect of it. And it does seem to be a pretty good vehicle for the Supreme Court to address this question about nationwide particularly preliminary injunctions issued by a district judge. So I would not be surprised if the Supreme Court actually uses this as an opportunity, as the Solicitor General requested, to end that practice. And so in some sense, that is a potential outcome that is very possible. The Supreme Court just says, like, look, we're not going to address the merits of the constitutional powers or the Fourth Amendment or the First Amendment or the vagueness type arguments, but we're just going to say that the district judge overreached in granting a nationwide injunction, which the parties hadn't even asked for, right? So that seems to be a possible scenario that might come to pass.
So another question is wondering about the onus of the reporting requirement. And they're saying kind of it seems that the onus is on the corporation, but any reporting liability, including fines or prison, is borne by the individual owners. So even if an owner wishes to file a BOIR, but the corporation does not, then the shareholders' hands appear to be tied. Is that your reading, or do you have a different reading?
I think that's an astute question. I mean, and I think that that's the correct reading, right? If you look at the way the statute is written, when it defines persons, and the penalties, it also includes imprisonment as a penalty. You can't imprison a corporation. So I think that that is an accurate reading of the statute. It's the persons who bear the penalties. So if you do have a situation where the person, the individual, turns over the information to the entity and the entity, for whatever reason, doesn't file, you could potentially be on the hook. One saving grace is the statute does say willful violations. So I think that if you're in a situation where you've given your personal information and the entity doesn't do that, then it seems to me that there'd be an argument that the person who actually gave the information wasn't willfully violating it. And this is a good opportunity to add another wrinkle, because this, the statute also has a duty to update the information that you have filed. And so you change an address, your driver's license or your passport expires. I mean, you have a duty to update that, right? And in that instance, you could potentially, if you know that you have a duty to update and you just decide, I'm just not going to do it because it's too much of a bother, I mean, that could be a willful violation. I should add one additional detail, which is right now, because the application for stay is pending at the Supreme Court and the last pronouncement on the nationwide injunction was by the Fifth Circuit merits panel, no one has to file right now, even though the statute purported to apply for all entities that had been filed before the applicable date by January 1st. So right now, no one has to file, right? So that's where we are right now.
A follow-up question to that is, you know, given your reading of the procedures, they want to know, why isn't that like the government telling registered gun owners they are responsible if a third party of its designation commits a murder?
So, I mean, I think the gun analogy is a little bit different, because I can't quite see the posture of an individual owner and bearing this relationship to an entity. But I think that the problem that's identified at a fundamental level is the same, right? You have an individual who is liable for something that falls on the third party, which is the reporting company, right? So this idea of being on the hook for something that is not under your control, that is there. I think that the gun example is a little bit far afield of this idea of setting up an entity. So I'm not absolutely sure what the answer to that is.
Fair. Do you envision, and maybe we touched on this earlier, but a little more specific, do you envision SCOTUS ruling only on the propriety of the nationwide injunction and not rule on the CTA itself? Can Justice Alito do this alone, or must it go to a full panel, or can this only be addressed with the writ of cert?
So I think he will refer it to the full court. He is the circuit justice in the Fifth Circuit. Justice Thomas is the circuit justice for the 11th Circuit. So I think this is important enough that he'll refer it to the court. And I do think there's a very strong possibility that they'll just rule on the nationwide injunction. I'm looking at the question and answer queue, and I see that Mr. Headley asked the question, will they just bypass the appeals pending in the circuit courts? I think the likelier scenario, because our case is fully briefed, whereas all the other cases were sort of preliminary injunctions where the posture is sort of an emergency posture, I think that the likelier is they could do that. I mean, it's the Supreme Court, they could, but my guess is the Supreme Court will just perhaps stay the nationwide injunction piece, but let our case, which is the fully briefed case, use that one to address the merits.
Great. Someone asked, what is the reach of this act? You know, do you know how many entities roughly would be swept into this database?
The government estimated 32.7 or 6 million. So, I mean, there's a lot of entities, even with the 24 exemptions that they've carved into the statute, which are intended to exempt like large public companies and so forth. So this is going to affect a lot of people.
So I think back to the states issue, which I found really interesting. Someone says, is it pretty clear that states have authority to require disclosure of beneficial owners and company applicants as a condition to the vesting of limited liability status under state law?
Yeah. Some states, like including New York, have enacted their own state versions of the CTA. Certainly, that would take out of play the constitutional power type arguments, right? Because the states are the ones chartering. And so right now, in our litigation, we've done a survey of the different states, and no one requires this beneficial owner information. But let's say some state were to do that, then it seems to me the constitutional arguments about Congress's power would not be available. You still might have Fourth Amendment and vagueness arguments, although I think the Fourth Amendment arguments are weaker in the context, because if the state is saying they're the ones that are granting the certificates of incorporation, so if the state says as a condition of incorporation, we're going to ask for this information, then that might be a problem. You could still make the argument if you were somebody who got your charter before the state version of the Corporate Transparency Act kicked in, because then somehow, you know, your expectation when you set up the entity wouldn't necessarily conform with that. But prospectively, perhaps the Fourth Amendment argument would be weaker. I mean, the vagueness arguments would still be there, right? Because what the New York version of the Corporate Transparency Act does, it essentially borrows the federal definition, which has this problem of defining beneficial owners, not just in terms of equity ownership. I mean, it would be much easier if you said, look, 25% is the threshold at which we're going to consider you someone who's a beneficial owner. But in trying to get as many disclosures as possible, they use this idea of substantial control. So that problem would still be there for a state statute that incorporated the federal definition of beneficial owners.
Someone wonders if there's any arguments about compelled speech to the government. And for those of your clients who haven't yet complied with the CTA, do you think time will be given to comply if the CTA should go back into effect?
When the litigation before the Supreme Court happened in the Fifth Circuit, FinCEN unilaterally extended the January 1st deadline by a couple of weeks. So let's say the Supreme Court decides on the merits and says that the statute is constitutional. I think that particularly under this administration, they would probably give parties who haven't yet filed the information some extra time, right? I mean, it just seems the fair thing to do. And I think that would probably happen. Again, I think we've got very strong arguments, so that's not necessarily the best prediction of what the Supreme Court would do. But I would imagine that FinCEN, particularly now, would give people more time to comply if the merits arguments do fail. I saw a question about homeowners associations. And sir, the person who asked the question, I mean, one of the cases in the Fourth Circuit is brought by a trade association for homeowners associations. And they had sought an exemption. FinCEN sort of denied it, but your question opens up the can of worms that this kind of disclosure rule enforces. And the reality is people do these jobs for free, and just the deterrence potential, like I serve on my condo board. I mean, you know, and my condo has to file disclosures. why would anyone necessarily want to serve, right? And so I think that's just another illustration of the poorly thought out aspects of this particular statute and the disclosure that it would affect. And I think that's a serious problem. And one of the cases in the Fourth Circuit, that preliminary injunction was denied by the district court, was brought by a trade group of homeowners association, particularly because of this feature of the statute.
Another interesting question is, someone asks, might the Trump administration order non-enforcement of the law through executive order, as he did with the TikTok bill? Could the Treasury Department revise the regulations to make them less onerous or exclude more categories of business entities?
Yeah. It is a statute of Congress, and the executive branch does have the constitutional responsibility to make sure that laws are faithfully executed. So I don't think that the administration could just ignore it or say that they're going to refuse to enforce it. But there's a lot of discretion with respect to the regulations, right? So, for example, I mentioned to you that the statute itself does not require those digital images. So FinCEN could get rid of that particular requirement, which seems to me particularly onerous and kind of accentuates the Fourth Amendment, potential Fourth Amendment violation of it, right? So they could do that. I mean, certainly they could roll back the timeline a bit and say, like, look, this is an important challenge and there are valid constitutional concerns about this statute. So we're going to suspend enforcement until we see how the Supreme Court decides the merits. I mean, they could do something like that. But the reality is it is a statute of Congress until it's repealed. Technically the administration would have to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. But there's a lot of daylight between what the statute requires and the nature of the regulations that have been implemented to enact it during the Biden administration. And I would imagine that the Trump administration would be much more protective of small businesses and how they choose to design and implement the regulations.
Reading through some of the questions, there seems to be a lot of questions about both the legislative history of CTA, meaning, how it kind of came about in Congress, and also kind of, are there efforts to, someone says both the Senate and House reintroduce bills to repeal the CTA? What are the likelihood those will pass?
Yeah. When the statute was put into the NDAA, it really was framed very much as an anti-terrorism and anti-money laundering initiative. And there was a lot of bipartisan support about it. A lot has changed in 5 years. And I think one of the biggest changes, which the TikTok opinion revealed, was I think the CTA was formulated and enacted at a period where there was a lot more, less regard for data privacy, right? And a lot more faith in big data and the government's ability to access big data. And I feel like the norms have changed quite a bit. I mean, there's some ringing language in the Supreme Court's TikTok opinion about the importance of data privacy. And so I think that people have become, and by people, I don't just mean my clients or small business owners. I think people have become much more ambivalent and suspicious about this idea of allowing accumulations of big data for admirable purposes, including money laundering. So I would not be surprised if those bills pick up some steam. I mean, I want to be fair. Money laundering is a serious problem. The problem that we have with this statute is setting up entities. I mean, people do that all the time. And if you're gonna crack down on money laundering, shouldn't you actually have money that's traveling in interstate commerce? I mean, people set up entities. Like, how is it guilty in any sense if you've set something up and you have an idea for something and it exists and you have to turn this information over to the federal government? So So, I mean, that's sort of the concern here.
I think that's very fair. So someone wants to know, for those who have already filed with FinCEN, how will their personal information be treated?
Yeah. So, I'm speculating a bit. So I would imagine that if the statute ultimately gets struck down as unconstitutional, the information that's been gathered will have to be deleted, right? I mean, they can't continue to keep it, right? So that will be part of the remedy. If it gets upheld, I think, they'll probably, I answered this question earlier, there'll probably be more time for people to turn over that information. But if it gets struck down, I think you're going to be good. It's not going to stay in some FinCEN database if you've turned it in. So you shouldn't have to worry about that.
And I think someone wants to know about kind of, are there any arguments about compelled speech to the government involved in this or not really?
There was a very interesting amicus brief in the Fifth Circuit case filed by some members of Congress, really bringing home the compelled speech argument. And the First Amendment is obviously a right that members of the Supreme Court on both sides, as a group, seem to take very seriously. And so it does seem a plausible argument, right? And which is why we made it. We raised the complaints. We raised it in our briefing. But if you were to sort of assess the different constitutional files that are presented by this statute, it seems to me that the unreasonable search and seizure, the fact that you're engaging in a fundamentally innocent activity and it's being put into a criminal law enforcement database and could be used against you when you're engaging in a fundamentally innocent activity, seems to be stronger, right? I mean, I can imagine entities that are set up for that have more of a non-business speech type agenda, right? And they would certainly have a very strong argument about compelled speech. The cases that we relied on in the 11th Circuit, for example, on this particular point involved adult businesses that there were sort of ordinances that required them to disclose the identity of the people who were owners of the adult business. And so that seems to me to be a very strong aspect, like a very strong case for compelled speech, right? And again, I'm speaking in my personal capacity. I think there's an argument to be made there. It doesn't seem quite as strong as the other constitutional arguments, but that just goes back to prove the point that this is an ill-conceived statute. Law enforcement really wanted it because it's a nice toy for them to have. I mean, in the old days, you think some entities involved in a fishy transaction, you'd have to get warrants, you'd have to engage in a lot of, gumshoe detective work to try to track down who's behind the entity. And the law enforcement authorities understandably said, look, this is too much red tape. We want to be able to have it all in a database and do searches and find out who the people are. And I can understand that, but I mean, you can't disregard the limitations on Congress's police power and the privacy rights of individuals just because it's a neat toy for law enforcement. I mean, as a number of the people here know, the pre-existing regime was the customer due diligence rule, which puts the onus on banks. So if you open up an account, the banks have to turn over information regarding beneficial owners of that information. And that seems to me, both from a policy perspective and certainly from a law perspective, a much more rational way to go about this, right? And So those rules are still there. And I want to emphasize again, my clients in the litigation are all for money laundering. It's just that basically this kind of statute that really gives the government too much for that purpose is a problem.
Understood. I think someone wants to know the implications for tribal nations, especially given that some tribes fall under Public Law 280 and how FinCEN anticipates enforcement on those lands.
Yeah, so the statute actually says entities formed under state and tribal laws. So it would set up, it would include entities that are set up under tribal laws. I'm not as familiar with entities that are set up under tribal laws, and FinCEN's regulations don't go into great detail about those. And so I'm speaking somewhat without definitive information, but my understanding is that the disclosure rules operate the same as to tribal entities as they would for state entities. One feature of it, I don't know if you guys have watched Ozark, the series, but the statute says that bearer certificates are prohibited, right? And my understanding is that all the states, nobody, bearer certificate being a proof of ownership that is fully transferable as long as you have the certificate. I don't know if there's some tribes that still have that. Right. But that would be one example of it. If there were some tribe that allowed entities to form and to authorize bearer certificates, there are some foreign jurisdictions that still authorize that to my knowledge. And certainly that would be one aspect in which tribal autonomy with regards to entity formation is restricted by the statute. And I should say the Constitution, you know, I said the Commerce Clause, but there's really three Commerce Clauses. There's the Foreign Commerce Clause, there's the Indian Commerce Clause, and then there's the Interstate Commerce Clause. And I suppose you could kind of make the argument, and again, this is me as a con law person, that perhaps Congress's power pursuant to the Indian Commerce Clause is broader because Indian tribes have this special relationship with the federal government sort of stands in a trustee position with respect to them. But to my knowledge, those arguments are not, have not been ventilated. And I just don't know how tribal entities laws work well enough to speak more informedly about that.
Someone asks, do you have any insight as to why the government's procedural inquiry does not require disclosure of beneficial owner percentages? So someone who exerts 47 to 97% corporate control, presumably if ever there were a credible money laundering charge asserted, wouldn't a percentage control be a defense element factor?
So I'm not absolutely clear on the question, right? So the way beneficial owners are defined are if you own more than 25% of the equity or have substantial control. So if you have a fact pattern where somebody, so it's not just about substantial control. So if you do have a situation where somebody has 47 to 90%, and presumably that would be a beneficial owner that the entity would have to disclose. I mean, what the government was trying to do. And so the policy, and I think I saw another question about there's the legal arguments and the policy arguments. What the government was trying to do was they were concerned about the situation where somebody has the ownership of the shares on paper, but somebody else is asserting actual control, like a front organization or something like that. And so that's why they wrote the substantial control part of it in there. Because you do see in other contexts, definitions of reporting requirements that are defined strictly in terms of equity ownership, but you know, the policy concern was, well, then you could sort of circumvent those requirements by having a set of paper owners, and there's real people who control it who wouldn't be disclosed. So that's what they're trying to do. And I think that it was inartfully drafted because in that desire to be sort of more robust in capturing these sort of shadow owners. They wrote the statute in a way that really is just too broad, right? Too vague.
Another interesting question was about lawyers who direct the formation of an entity on behalf of their clients. Would they be subject to the disclosure requirements due to the control issue?
Yeah. So lawyers, so there's two prongs. Most of the action has been about beneficial owners, but the statute also says applicants and for entities going forward, right? And so when they define applicants, and I have to confess, I haven't looked at this part of the statute recently. I think that if I recall correctly, the way the regulations, and I would appreciate help from somebody, if somebody in the audience knows, but I think reading the definition of applicant, like a lawyer who does the paperwork, would potentially qualify as an applicant, right? And so the names of the lawyers who set up the corporation may also be required to be disclosed under the applicant prong for future corporations that are set up.
Another interesting question. So someone said, you know, recognizing that the Commerce Clause and other constitutional provisions may place limits on the scope of the U.S. government authority to require ownership reporting, how serious do you regard the national security and criminal activity threats that shell companies are used for various purposes? And they say, you know, could the type or number of companies required to provide information or the amount of information be more narrowly tailored to survive, you know, kind of constitutional challenges?
Yeah. So one of the strong, my automatic light turned off. Can you still see me?
Yes.
Yeah. So one of the reasons, one of the origins behind the statute was there's an international task force, financial action task force, that recommended the development of these kinds of databases regarding owners of entities for the sake of money laundering. And I will say that, and this goes back to something I said earlier about why the statute happened. There was a great deal of sort of faith in big data and perhaps less of an appreciation for data privacy. But I should say even the International Task Force has backed off a little bit on their guidance, right? I mean, granted, from a litigation posture, these are more recently updated recommendations of the Financial Action Task Force. But in the most recent guidelines, they do say, like, you know, you don't absolutely have to set up a database. There's a cost benefit analysis that you can undertake, right? And so I think even at the international level, there's a recognition that this type of requirement may sweep too broadly. And I'm putting aside the fact that, I mean, international, it's important that the United States comply with international obligations, but this is not a treaty. It's not actually an obligation. These are guidelines from a task force. And as I said, the task force guidelines have themselves been updated. So I think that the argument that we have to do this because some international body has determined that it's necessary for anti-money laundering, that body has backed off from the idea that it's required. And frankly, as a matter of constitutional law, we're not obligated to follow international recommendations. We're the United States, right? Congress happened to have written the statute at a point where the Financial Action Task Force had this kind of more aggressive view of what was required. But we don't have to follow that. Our estate planning trusts and LLPs required to file. The trigger is if you are required to file or register by a state secretary of state as an entity. So if you're using a trust or some other form of juristic vehicle that doesn't require you to file, then the CTA would not kick in, right? So I'm not a TNA expert, so I can't speak more informedly, but the trigger is that requirement to file for a certificate. Or if you're a foreign business, if you're required to file a registration with the state secretary of state. So that's the trigger. So if you're using some kind of legal mechanism that doesn't require that filing, then presumably you would not be subject to the CTA.
Another question, which I found useful because I don't know the answer. Did the government ever say why they need the personal information of every single corporate controller for small corporations, most of which don't make enough money to launder?
No, I mean, I think it's law enforcement thinks that if they collect all this information, it'll make their job easier, right? And I think I'm sort of repeating something that I'd said earlier. Granted that that may be true, right? Like, let's say there's some phishing transaction or something fishy, or they suspect money laundering, and there's an entity named, and then you could sort of type the entity into the FinCEN database and you get a list of actual human beings. Yes. And I was talking earlier about this. In my prior career, before I was a lawyer, I was a naval cryptology officer. And so there was this, and I witnessed it. I mean, I'm dating myself because this was in the 90s. So when I sort of entered the intelligence business, the model was the command authorities identify collection priorities. We really want to know this information. We really want this information, like how many ballistic missile submarines the Soviet Union has, where they are, where they're patrolling, and then the intelligence authorities and it would be tasked to find that information out. And there's been sort of a shift because the technology has enabled the government to say, okay, well, we're going to do things differently. We're just going to vacuum up all this information, store it in a database. And then should the need arise for law enforcement or intelligence, they can tap into it, right? Because we're not going to know prospectively what we need. And I understand the appeal and even the compelling need for that when you're sort of dealing with national security threats. But part of the problem here is we're not talking about, you know, foreign entities. We're talking about U.S. entities. And to use that kind of rationale and direct it toward Americans, primarily overwhelming majority of innocent Americans who set up entities for their own purposes are engaging in a fundamentally innocent activity just because those entities exist. I mean, that is fundamentally problematic and I would submit unconstitutional. And that's sort of what's going on here.
I think that's very helpful. Well, this has been terrific. I don't know if you have any further thoughts or if there are any questions that I missed that you wanted to quickly answer. I guess we have a couple at the end. Someone wants to know.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see the one about 47, yeah. And I think I misunderstood it. So the question really is, why doesn't the disclosures require sort of a identification of actually how much you own? And I think I sort of answered it sideways, right? Because they're not just interested in that information. And I guess the question is like, so if you know that somebody's 47%, you could put like a double asterisk next to it and say, this is a real threat as opposed to 25%. And maybe, you know, but in some sense, that's more information. It would make more sense. But again, the government's instinct is to have everything in there and to ask questions and consult it later. Right. And I see this last question. Would a solo law firm sub S corporation have to include information about a non-lawyer spouse in a community property state? I mean, it would depend on whether or not that non-lawyer spouse has an equity share or exercises substantial influence in the corporation. And I'm not a property lawyer, but I think that question, I sympathize with the lawyers on the ground who have to answer those kinds of questions, right? I mean, in some sense, maybe not, but you'd have to look into it and expend hours trying to figure out what the answer is, right? And so it's a classic example of a situation where why exactly is the federal government forcing people to do things like this, right?
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Lee for the benefit of his time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.